And the degeneracy depends on topology, on the topology of the system. And so if we are on a Riemann surface, so it's a two-dimensional surface, this would be some number to the genus of the surface. And I remind you that for a sphere, g equals 0, for a torus, g equals 1, and so on and so forth. So it's the number of holes or handles in the Riemann surface. And if our system is not a Riemann surface, but is a three-dimensional object, then it would be something different that doesn't necessarily have to have this form. And the third requirement is that different ground states are locally indistinguishable. Okay. And we use as our, so the simplest model that has topological quantum order is this model that we can, so let me draw a square lattice with periodic boundary conditions. And we place spins 1/2 on the edges of our lattice. So for every edge, there is a local Hilbert space that is just the linear space with the complex coefficients associated to two vectors. So this is a spin 1/2. And the Hilbert space is simply the tensor product of all these local Hilbert spaces. And there are, so if we have L times L lattice, we have two L square spins, edges on a square lattice with periodic boundary conditions. And the Hamiltonian of the system is minus U, the sum of some operators that are defined on the sides, minus J, some other operators that are defined on the plaquettes, minus H, some external field, where these AS operators, so they are defined on the sides in this way. So we consider all the edges that come out from a site. So that's why we call them star operators. And they're just the product over all the spins that come out of S. So this is the site S of sigma x j. And the BP are operators that have support on the four spins that make a plaquette. So the plaquette operator BP, plaquette, is the product of all the spins that belong to the plaquette of sigma z. Okay. And we are right now studying the case H equals 0. So we have seen that we can define two quantum numbers that are global, that are, we call them W1, that is the product of sigma z on all the spins that go around a contractible loop around the torus, and W2 is the same thing for the other one. And we have that these commutation relations, all the operators commute with each other, and of course also AS, AS prime. So this is easy because they all contain only sigma x operators, so they must commute, and the same for the plaquette operators. But moreover, and therefore, AS and the Hamiltonian commute, and the same for the, so this is a consequence of what I just wrote. They commute for H equals zero. So we are starting with this case. And moreover, also W1, Z. So because I'm acting with the Z operator, let me call them W1, W2, Z. Also W1 and W2, Z commute with the Hamiltonian. Okay. So this means that I can define some other operators that I call W2X and W1X, and I define them by drawing a string on the dual lattice, and then I operate with the sigma x on all the spins that are met. So with this, you will see that Wi square with the z operators and with the x operators is the identity. And here I is either one or two. And Wi z Wx j is equal to, so let me put I here, zero. Otherwise, they commute. So Wi z Wx j equals zero when I is different from j. So this is, these are the algebraic properties of the model. Oh, and for H equals zero, so this part of the Hamiltonian is called toric code, and I will call it HTC. And it was introduced by Kitaev in the 97. Okay. So what is the ground state of our system? So this is the ground. In fact, I have to say ground space, because being degenerate is a subspace of my Hilbert space. So it's the set of all the states in my Hilbert space such that AS psi is equal BP psi is equal psi. Okay. So this is a consequence of the fact that all the operators are mutually commuting, and they have two eigenvalues that are plus one and minus one. So I gain the minimum energy. So the ground state energy is zero. Is minus n, n is the number of spins. Sorry, is the number of plaquette operators. So every time we put the eigenvalue of 1 BP to 1, we have an energy minus J. We have n of them, so we have minus nj. And now the number of plaquette operators is equal to the number of star operators. And but every time we put eigenvalue plus 1 in the Hamiltonian, we have an energy that is minus u. So the ground state energy is minus nj plus u. And by the way, this number n is L square, because it's equal to the number of sites on the lattice. So for every site, we have a star operator. So this is obvious. But then you can see that you, on a square lattice, you can reproduce a dual lattice that is the one that is obtained by using S sites at the centers of plaquettes. And you see that this lattice is self-dual. So you have as many sites as plaquettes. So this is also the number of plaquettes. So this is the ground state energy. And so now imagine that phi 0 belongs to L. So it's some state in our ground space. Well, now W1 phi 0 also is in L. And I will show you that it's actually orthogonal to phi 0. So let me call this state phi 1. And we have that phi 1, phi 0 is equal 0. Or if you want that the expectation value of W1 in phi 0 is 0, because this is the same thing. And the reason why I will always forget to put the daggers here is that for these operators, they are Hermitian. Okay? Which is something that you can easily check, because they are just products of either sigma x operators, sigma z operators. So. Well, so this is true also if I put W2, or if I put the product of W1, W2. So this means that I can write this subspace, like the linear space on complex coefficients of these four vectors, phi 0, W1 phi 0, W2 phi 0, W1, W2. Phi 0. So it's fourfold degenerate. So now you see, this is also another way of deriving the degeneracy. For every hole that I have in my torus, I have, and here I have to put x. I could also put z, but let me choose x so that we are in the so-called z basis. So effectively, this wx acts like the spin flip operator on this non-local spin that is defined on the non-contractible loops of the torus. So you see that for every hole that we have in the torus, we have two copies of the spin-off algebra. So namely means that we get a pair W1, W2, which gives us four states. But if I put another handle, I will have another pair W1 prime, W2 prime, and therefore I will have 16 states now, right? Because I can do all the possible products of these W operators. So in general, the degeneracy will be equal to 4 to the number of holes that I have. Because for every hole, I get 4 operators, the identity in these other 3 combinations, or to the G, or 2 to the 2G, as we said yesterday, by a counting argument of what are the degrees of freedom that are missing. So the other thing is that if L prime is the ground space of the Z2 lattice gauge theory, in which you remember the Hilbert space is a subspace of the total Hilbert space given by those states that are identified through a gauge transformation. But so, as you can see, L is included in L prime. Sorry, L is included in H phis. So that they have the same ground space. So L. And in particular, the whole, if U is much larger than J, the low energy sector, so it's the Hilbert space, so H low, the low energy sector of H, which means the states in H that have an expectation value of the energy that is smaller than some, than U. Well, then we saw that H law is the gauge invariant subspace. Namely, because being a gauge invariant subspace means that we respect this constraint. If we respect this constraint, we see that our energies are of the order J. So we don't access the energies that are of order U that is much larger than J. So the low energy sector is a lattice gauge theory. OK. So now we want to see some properties of the ground state. So we want to, for instance, find explicitly what is phi zero in terms of our spins. Because when we write it in this way, then we will be able to say, to spell out many properties like the local indistinguishability. Because for the local indistinguishability, I have to define a subregion A of my spins, and then I have to trace out to the rest, and I have to see what happens to different states. So I have to do this. OK, so, well, phi zero is in L, right? So this means that must be some state that simultaneously obeys all these constraints for every S and for every P. So I didn't, L is defined by this constraint being true for every S and every P. OK, so we find a state like this using this trick. So first of all, we use a reference state that can be very useful. I will call it zero. Now, this is a global zero. So this is a many-body state. So I should put zero tilde because I've called zero one of the states of the local Hilbert space on one spin. And so I may forget the tilde at some point while I write. So And this state is defined like simply the state with all spins up in the Z basis. So this means that for every sigma z operator acting on any spin, I just get the eigenstate of eigenvalue plus one. Okay, so now you can easily see that BP on this reference state is equal the reference state again for every P. Well, this is because BP is nothing else than four sigma z operators around the plaquette. So when they act on the all spins up state, they return me the same state, because this is what I mean by spins up in the z basis. So you see that this state zero tilde has this property, so it obeys this constraint. So now the trick that I want to use is the following. I start with this state, and I project, then I choose one of these constraints. So for instance, AS for S equal one. Remember, S has value from one to L squared. So I choose A1. And I want to project my state onto the subspace of the Hilbert space that respects this constraint. So I want to project onto this subspace. Now, two things can happen. If my reference state has null projection onto the subspace, I didn't solve anything. Means that zero tilde is not a good reference state. But if it does, I have found a state that simultaneously obeys all these constraints plus this one. Right? Because it belongs to the common subspace defined by these two constraints. So let's see what is this projector. So I want to find P1, the projector onto the subspace. I could call it L1, that is the states such that A1 psi is equal to psi. Okay, so this projector pi1 is identity plus A1 over 2. Let's check it. So we have to check two things, that pi1 squared is equal to pi1, right? Because this means to be a projector. And then for every state, we have to check that when I apply pi1 on it, I indeed am in a state that respects this constraint. OK, so let's check this. So what is pi1 squared? This is 1 over 4. Then I have the identity plus a squared. But a squared is, again, the identity. So this is twice the identity. And then I have 2a1. Well, so this is obviously 1 plus a1 over 2, which is pi1. OK, so it is a projector. OK? Now, let me take some state chi. And let me define my projection on this subspace pi1 chi. So now I want to check that I'm wondering whether pi1 chi belongs to L1. So what do I have to do? I have to apply A1 on chi and obtain chi again. Well, so you see that you have A1 times A1 plus the identity over 2 times A1 over pi 1 chi, sorry. So I want to check that this state is in L1. So I want to apply A1 on this state and obtain that state again. No, no. So I am saying that if I take a state and I project it with this projector, so we know this is a projector, right? So this is another state. And I want to show you that this state belongs to L1. So, or in other words, it respects this constraint. So to check this, I simply have to apply A1 on this state and see if I obtain that state again. So I apply A1 on this state, but this state is by definition A1 plus 1 over 2 times chi. Well, but you see that this gives me pi 1 again. Okay, so this is checked. Ah, okay. Well, then I could project onto pi 2. Right? So if I project onto L2 by pi 2, then I would have a state that respects all the BP's constraints plus the A1 constraint plus the A2 constraint. And then I can exhaust all the constraints in this way. And the order in which I perform these projections doesn't matter because all these projection operators commute because all the AS and BPs commute with each other, so because of those commutation relations up there. So this means that if I define phi 0, like the product over all the vertices of 1 plus AS over 2 onto my reference state, then this one belongs to my ground space. And therefore, because I know what are the W operators, they are just the products of sigma x around a non-contractible loop, then I also know who are W150, W250, and the others. So I have constructed explicitly the whole ground space. Okay, so we want now to expand this product. Okay? So also remember that because the product of all the AS is the identity, so once I have projected on n minus 1 of these projectors, the last one is just the identity, right? So this product can go from 1 to n minus 1, which is L squared minus 1. Because the last one is useless, the last constraint. It's automatically satisfied. Okay, now I want to expand this. Okay, so if you expand this, there is another thing. When you project, when you use a projector operator, this does not conserve the norm. So this means that although these states belong to L, they are not normalized. So in the end, I have to put some normalization N, calligraphic N, that I will find at the end. Okay, so I have N. Well, now let's expand this product. So you will see that you have the identity. Oh, here you also have 2 to the L squared minus 1, right? But this doesn't really matter because I have to find the normalization anyway. So I don't care what is the coefficient. Then I have the product of AS with some other AS. So AS, AS prime. And I can do it in all possible ways, right? So I have the sum over all the possible S and S prime of products of this type. Then I have the sum over all the possible products with three of them. And so on and so forth.
Why
does he? Oh, because I forgot. Plus, thank you. So, another way of expressing this sum is the sum over all the possible products of AS with each other. So if I define in this way this set, G is equal, so this is just a notation. This is the set of all the possible products of some A with some other A. And it is also a group, right? So every time you define the set of all the possible products with some multiplication, in this case, remember that this multiplication contains also a tensor product because these operators have different supports. So every time you take the set of all the possible groups, all the possible products with respect to some product of some set, it's called the set of generators, so you obtain a group. So this G is a group. So I can write this like some normalization, the sum over all the group elements in G acting on the reference state. And so this was acting on the reference state, of course. Well, then to find the normalization, I simply have to count how many elements there are in this group. So I have to find the cardinality or order of this group. Well, we use the fact that all these objects square to the identity. So this means that we don't need to worry too much what is the product of each of them with themselves. So how many elements I have here? Well, I have 2 to the L squared minus 1. Right? I have L squared minus 1 generators, and therefore I have 2 to the L squared minus 1 possible products of that. And therefore, this is just a second. G to the minus 1 half sum of G, capital G, G, 0 tilde, yeah?
Okay, okay, no, this G was missing, right?
Sorry?
No, this was missing before in the sum, so I didn't know what.
Sorry. Sometimes another notation is to call G on this reference state just ket G. Okay. So this means that we can identify our reference state with the identity of our group onto this. This is just notation, basically. OK. So we know what our phi 0 explicitly looks like. And so let me give you a geometric picture of this. So this is very important. So we can give a geometric picture to this group that will make us realize that our ground state is what we call a string net condensate. OK. Okay. So I have already shown you that I can define some string operators that, in particular, they were closed, right? They were closed loops, and they chose some non-contractible loop. So the rule in general for a general string operator, so let me call it WC, is that you pick C any curve in L. This is our lambda is our lattice. Or C prime any curve in lambda prime being the dual lattice. Again, the dual lattice is the one that has four sides, the centers of the plaquette. Okay, so let me pick one curve. On lambda, okay? So it might be an open string, or it might be a loop. If it's an open string, it has two endpoints, okay? And then what I do is that I operate with sigma z on all the spins that live on this curve, okay? So WC will be the product of all the spins in C of sigma z. We have seen that when C is the non-contractible loop C1, then WC1 is what I call W1, right? W1z. So here I can always put a z to remind me what type of operators I'm using. No. No. So also, now we are using this theory in the full Hilbert space. So now we don't care about gauge invariant anymore. So you can ask whether, so as long as it's clear for you what you mean. If you, by gauge invariant, now it's just a jargon to say, if it respects the constraint AS. So yeah, so this is a sensible question. The answer is no. An open string does not respect this constraint. So this would be, if I apply this operator onto my reference state, I would have a high energy state, a state that has energy of order U. So in fact, let me just finish this definition, then we will compute the expectation value of the energy of a state like this. So for C prime instead, so C prime is some curve that is joining the centers of the plaquettes because it lives in the dual lattice. So I will collect all the spins that are intersected by this string, and I will operate with sigma x on them. Okay? And now we see two things, that when C, C prime are closed, so if they are loops, then WX C prime commutes with the Hamiltonian, and WZ C commutes with the Hamiltonian. So this is the new statement. Says, okay, so these loop operators always commute with the Hamiltonian. And always remember that I'm considering the case H equals zero, so my Hamiltonian here is always the one of the toric code when h is equal to 0. OK, so before seeing what is the energy of high energy states, let me complete the description of our ground state. because we want to understand what this phi zero look like. Well, now look that a star operator, what is a star operator doing? Let me draw it here. So star operator is centered at some site, and it is applying sigma x on these four spins. So a star operator corresponds to a small loop in the dual lattice by our definition. In particular, the star operator is one of these small loop operators. And what happens when I multiply two star operators that are nearby? Well, then I have the product of these two loops. But this means that on the common spin, I am operating with sigma x twice, which gives us the identity. So as usual, when I multiply these operators, the interior cancels. So I just obtain a bigger loop. So a generic product of many AS operators is a bunch of loop operators that can be disconnected. It can be a large loop operator, can be many loop operators around the lattice. So a G is some loop, G in G, is some loop operator. But again, by loop, I mean that can be also the product of different loops. So our phi zero is simply the sum over all the possible loops. So this is what is our ground state phi zero. And all these loops are all, let me say, trivial loops, meaning that there is nothing non-contractible here. They all act on my reference state or spins up. So again, what is a loop? So now we have a picture. I start from all spins up. Then I draw some loop. And I simply put down, because I'm operating with the sigma x, all the spins that are on the loop. And the reason why I drew this on the dual lattice is because G is defined from the product of the AS operator, and the AS operator, as I showed you, they live on the lattice. They live on the their loops on the, in the dual lattice. So of course, this construction is arbitrary. I could have started from a reference state in the x basis, and then I would have the sum over all the possible loops in the z basis that are all the possible loops that live in the original lattice and are made by z operators. So you don't obtain the same state, but you obtain the same construction, meaning that you obtain another state in L, and then you can construct the other orthogonal states by applying the W operators. So notice that what is important is that we have the sum of all the possible loop configurations, all with the same weight. So no matter how large are these loops, they all have the same weight. So when we switch on an external magnetic field H, you start seeing that. So this is sigma z on every spin, right? So it seems that I pay some energy for every piece of string that I have, because I have sigma z also when I switch on H. So H acts like a tension for the strings. So the picture that you must have in mind is that as long as the tension is below some critical value, the increase of energy that we give to a large string is very small, and therefore our our states gain some different weights, but they do not become too much unbalanced. But when H is above some critical value, then you have that you pay exactly one unit of H for every piece of string. So in the ground state, you don't want to have large strings. So the low energy states contain only some small strings. So you don't have this big soup of strings that I will show you is the essential property of topological order. And in particular, you have what is called the linear confinement, because the strings are confined by an energy barrier that is linear in the size of the string. Whereas in the other case, they are deconfined. And this confinement-deconfinement transition corresponds to the confinement-deconfinement transition of the underlying gauge theory. So they are the same thing. In fact, in the context of gauge theories, now this is a boring gauge theory because it's just a Z2. But if it was some other discrete group, this would give you the phenomenon of confinement for quarks in the lattice version of quantum chromodynamics. And maybe in the last lecture, I will have the time to elaborate more about this. But so the mechanism is the same. So how do we know that there is a critical transition for H? Well, we can do a mapping. So this will be one of your tutorials or homework. By this mapping, so this mapping is non-local. So it contains something that is like a Jordan-Wigner string. But by this mapping, the lattice gauge theory and so remember that when I switch on H at low energies, I am still in the lattice gauge theory because that H term, I chose it on purpose that is not creating excitations of order U because it's commuting with AS. So it's compatible with our gauge structure. So the Z2 lattice gauge theory maps into the 2D quantumizing model. So in which we can find what is the critical H, although not by exact solution, because in 2D we don't have an exact solution for the quantum model. But numerically, you can do that. And so this mapping preserves the relevant spectral properties. So you know what is the size of the gap as a function of H. So at least at the leading order, you know what is the critical theory. So you know that there must be a critical value of H. And when H is very, very large, well, you can understand that the ground state is just all the spins polarized in one direction. So this ground state is unique. So you lose this degeneracy. So because there is a critical value, you can expect that in the whole phase above this critical value, you lose your degeneracy, which is one of the landmarks of topological order. Now, in the last 5 minutes, let me show you that two states that are orthogonal, so phi 0 and W1 phi 0, are locally indistinguishable. Which is our key property. Okay, so what we have to do is that we have to define rho 1 is the density matrix of phi 0. And then rho 2 is the density matrix of W1 phi 0. So I can write it this way. And again, W1 dagger is just W1. Then what I do is that I choose some subregion in my lattice lambda. I choose some subregion A. As long as A doesn't see the holes of the torus, so it must be, can also be a large region, but contractible. So topologically, must be trivial. And then I will compute rho 1A equal to the trace over B of rho 1, and similarly for 2. Okay? And then I want to show you that rho 1A is identically equal to rho 2A. And also, this does not depend on what particular choice of orthogonal states I chose. It means that if I do some rotation in my Hilbert space, and then I will still find the same thing. So the second part can be an exercise, in fact. OK, so let's show this. OK, so what is, let me write explicitly rho 1. OK, so now we will have to use our tensor product structure in our Hilbert space. Because, OK, so we would like to write this in this way. So we have g, g prime, and then I have g 0 tilde, 0 tilde, g prime. And OK, then here I have a normalization. OK, so far, so good. Now, you have to remember that 0 tilde is nothing else than 0 everywhere on all the spins in my lattice. And what is G? Well, G is the product of some AS operators. Yeah. Or as I wrote before, you see on every spin I have a span of 0 and 1. Yeah, so 0 is the spin up. Now, what is G? G is the product of some AS operators, right? For instance, AS1 times AS5. But what is this? This would mean that there are four sigma x's somewhere, and these are some four other sigma x's somewhere else. Possibly they overlap or not. But in the end, every G has the shape that is the tensor product of sigma x operators around some loop. So I wrote it like this. So I to some belonging to some loop. Tensor the identity everywhere else. Right? Yeah.
When you say
so set loops. Okay. What is important though is that given a bipartition of the lattice, each of these sigma x either acts on A or acts on B. And you see, this is always a product. It's not the sum over different products with some coefficients. So every G is purely a product. So I can always write it like some GA tensor GB, where GA is some product of sigma x's and GB is some other product of sigma x's. Okay? So of course, each of these parts does not need to be a loop. So, because if I have a loop like this, I have GA is this open string here, and GB is this other open string here. But right now I don't care. I just know that an open string is a product of sigma x operators. So I can write this in this way. Well, also this will factorize in the identity, sorry, all spins up on A times all spins up in B, right? It's a product state. So I can write this in this way, G, G prime. And then I have G A, 0A, 0A, G prime A, tensor, G B, 0B, 0B, G prime B. So now let me take row 1A. So this is the trace over B of row 1. So how do I do the trace? Well, I simply sum on all the diagonal elements here, meaning, sorry, on all the diagonal elements that I obtain on the B part. Or in other words, this is just the 1 over G, sum G, G prime, GA, 0A, 0A, G prime A, and then I have times, this is just a number now, 0B, GB, G prime B, 0B. So with these coefficients. Okay, so this is the trace. You can obtain this passage by inserting the resolution of the identity in between. Okay, so this is row 1A. Now let's see row 2A. Okay, so now row 2A would be the same thing, though I have to add the WA, right? On the GA part. And also here. Now look that also the W's are products of sigma x operators, so they square to the identity. So this is the identity, right? Well, of course, we are left with this part here. So now we use the trick of topological order. So the trick of topological order is that if I have some state in my ground space, then G psi, where G is any element in big G. Yeah, you don't see. Sorry about that. Well, then I'll move to this other. Okay. So let G be an element in our group G. Let psi be a state in our ground space. Then psi is invariant under G. Why? Well, because G is some product of AS, and psi is invariant under the action of every AS because it is in L, and L is defined, where is it now? But, so L is defined as the subspace that is invariant under all the AS transformations together with all the BP transformations. Okay, so this is true, right? So in particular, I can pick any element in G, and I can multiply it by our state. and obtain again the same state. So I'm free to put here any g tilde that I want on A and the same in B. But this doesn't matter really because they square to the identity again. Okay, but so I'm free to put any g tilde that I want. So now it comes the trick.
So it will be
it can be anything that is contractible. Doesn't need to be in the A region, right? The whole G tilde as a part on A and a part of B, as long as it is contractible, right?
But when you split the WU1 in WUA and the WUB, the WUA will be an open string.
But
it's an open string, it's an element of G, right?
An open string is not an element of G. So the global one is an element of G. The trick that I want to do is the following. So this is my subregion A. Now, two things can happen. That my W operator touches A, or that my W operator does not touch A. Of course. Touches A or does not touch A. So if it doesn't touch A, in this expression, WA is just the identity. And I'll show you what happens. If it touches A, then it is not the identity. But then I can pick a G tilde. And what does the G tilde do? Well, it's some loop operator. So let me choose this loop operator here. So what does this loop do? What does this loop do? It cancels here because they overlap, right? And it deforms the loop outside of A. So now you see that I am free to gauge transform with my G's our loop operator so that they always live outside A. So if they live outside A, this means that the WA part is the identity, and they only live here. Well, if the WA part is the identity, I can erase here. And because they square the identity on B, we get exactly the same expression that we have above, which proves that rho 1A is equal to rho 2A. Is it clear? So now it's late. Tomorrow I'll show you that this local indistinguishability together with the gap means that this degeneracy is very robust under perturbations, which is the key property for applications of this type of system. And then we will explore what happens. So the other important feature of topological order is that excitations have a very rich statistics, a way of behavior.